Welcome to a new 74 podcast series, Culture in a Time of Crises. I'm Shwetal Patel, host of the series in which we explore art making and art making practices during these times of crises. Join us to hear from diverse artists and thinkers about how they've spent their lockdowns and the impact it has had on their working methods. Goshka Makuga is a London-based conceptual artist working in a variety of media, including sculpture, installation, photography, architecture, and design, as well as performance and video. Welcome to 74 Podcast, Goshka.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I want to start really at the beginning. You were born and raised in Warsaw in Poland. Can you tell us something about your childhood and adolescent years?
So paradoxically, I do have very good memories of living in Poland and my childhood. But I mean, it's sort of from the perspective of time, really. And I've discovered recently by reunited with a friend from my sort of first school who left when we were teenagers and moved to Germany. We met again maybe about 5 years ago, and she showed me all the letters that I used to send to her when we were children. And in these letters, I sounded very depressed and miserable. And I think that the only thing that was kind of underlying in everything that I said to her is that I was longing to leave the country and find something else and to escape the whole reality of living in Eastern Bloc.
That's very interesting. Thank you. I read a quote somewhere where you said, "My life and my education in communist Poland taught me that instead of referring to readily available written histories, one needs to search further for some sort of truth." Can you explain this feeling?
Well, so this obviously has to do with the very real scenario of learning history. You know, we were brought up I have to say that in general, I would consider that this was a very good education with very broad spectrum of subjects and interests. So, for example, my secondary school involved maybe 17 subjects that we all had to pass exams from at the end. And this included languages, maths, physics, you know, science plus art, art history, technology of painting. But of course, then when things changed in 89 and things started to be revealed, I mean, we knew at the time that what we were learning or what we were told, that big parts of it was just a propaganda and it wasn't really following the real facts of what happened. So even I remember being 10 and going to learn some sort of basis of English language, my teacher, who was then in her 70s, she had this terrible story of her son being killed in Katyn, you know, where all the Polish officers or anybody who was trained for military kind of from the military perspective was literally executed, you know, in thousands before the war started. And this wasn't something that anybody could talk about. It wasn't the official information. And of course, lots of stuff like this came out after 89, after, you know, all the kind of historical books have been rewritten and the truth has been discussed. I mean, there were various things shocking to me, like, for example, the informers, people who would inform the police. And the scale of it, no one knew how big it was, but it was enormous that almost in every single family, one was conditioned to report to the police. Otherwise, you would have not been able to have your children go to the university, or you would have not been able to get a flat or a job. So anyway, these almost sound like anecdotes, but in the perspective of all of this time, you then realize that what you learn, what you are being told, it's not necessarily the truth. And this doesn't have to be judged from the perspective of 20 or 30 years, certain things that happened last year, or, you know, big question of how the COVID-19 originated. Absolutely, I have never heard an answer that sounded convincing to me. So I think that it's the recollection of facts and the interpretation of facts that is kind of open to change always, and not necessarily through our subjective opinion or means. It's just the way history is, in a way, formed and reformed continuously.
When did you begin to understand this?
I think that I was much more interested in this recontextualization or the ideas of context. I would say probably even after I graduated from Goldsmiths.
In the mid-90s. So we'll come to that in a little bit, but I wanted to ask you, was it around this time that you decided that you wanted to study art? I mean, how did that decision come about?
I wanted to study art from the age of 15. That's why I went to the secondary art school in Poland. And in fact, I was interested in many things. I think that I was mainly passionate in classical dance and music, not very much encouraged to pursue this kind of career. So then the secondary choice for me was to potentially go to the art school, because my father was actually quite close to lots of artists. And for him, that was something that he would have aspired to. So, you know, so I was it was fine for me to do that. And so since the age of 15, I followed this path, you know, and of course, after finishing that initial school in Poland, I did have an aspiration to study, and applied twice in the to get to the art academy in Warsaw. I wasn't accepted. Two times I think was to study conservation of icons in St. Petersburg, because at that time we still had great relationship with other countries of Eastern Bloc. So you could actually go and study in Russia. There were certain possibilities of doing things like this, but thanks God I didn't, because if I did get the place, I would have lived in Russia during perestroika. Mm. And I already then came to the UK in 89, but the friends of mine who did go to study conservation of icons in St. Petersburg were there for several years. And I went to visit them in the 90s when I was, I think, already at St. Martin's. And I must say that it was pretty intense experience. You know, it was in the midst of huge crisis that people had to somehow survive in a foreign country.
So you arrived in London in 1989 to join Central St. Martin's for your foundation degree?
Yes, so I first came and I started my foundation course maybe 2 years later, because of course the whole process of application, acceptance and the beginning of the course took a little bit of time.
And your English was very rudimentary or maybe even non-existent?
Almost non-existent.
And how did you learn English?
Well, it was purely through conversation, and you know, that's why my spelling is dreadful. And also the actual general writing is pretty bad, which is very disappointing because I was very good at writing in my own language. And but it's improving, you know. I'm also a little bit dyslexic, so this is even more difficult, because I think that the nature of English grammar is very different to Polish, because we write as we speak. So it's phonetic, almost the same as Italian. And then it's much easier, but I'm getting better, definitely.
And why London and not, let's say, Paris or Rome or Berlin?
Well, it's a good question. I think that it was initially about connections. So I had a friend who I knew from Poland, who left and lived here. And she was very encouraging and very inviting me to come and stay with her. So when I came here, it wasn't really to stay. It was to visit a friend for 2 weeks. And of course, you need to know that we didn't have passports, you know, during my whole childhood, up to the time when I left. If you wanted to travel anywhere, you had to apply for a passport, but then immediately return this passport when you returned back to your country. And Plus, of course, going to the UK or going to United States was an absolute nightmare. You had to apply for a visa. You had to prove that you had certain income, you know, and even if people were in very comfortable financial situation in Poland, the translation of currency, you know, if you had a lovely house, if you sold that house, you would just about to afford maybe buying a cheap car, you know, or something like this. So no one had the money in order to travel or to there was just a complete kind of situation that was, you know, that did not allow us to have access to anywhere outside of Eastern Bloc where prices were comparable and the kind of incomes were comparable. So so it was a great challenge for me to be able to come to London and for my family to feel confident that I was safe and that I could survive. And and that's how it all started, really.
And tell us a little bit about those years in the early 90s in art school in London. What was going on? Where were you living? What was the atmosphere like? Must have been quite an incredible kind of very creative time, really.
It was, but it was also a time where I guess I had to assume that YBAs were very much based on the culture of Britain.
The young British artists.
Yes. And the knowledge of sort of different, you know, different roots, such as, I mean, even soap operas or, you know, this kind of in-core British.
Very British sensibilities.
Exactly.
And cultural references.
Exactly. Yeah. That were, you know, that it's not something that you study. It's something that you learn as you live. You know, it's a kind of culture that you learn more from the family and the street rather than something that you will study at school or so. And it was very much also within the language. So for me, this wasn't really accessible in any way. I remember that I started watching Brookside, you know, which was like more Liverpool base, and couldn't really relate to it almost at all. But of course, EastEnders, you know, this stuff, I wouldn't even understand what people were saying. You know, I could understand just sort of minor parts of things because of the limitation of English. And so I did feel slightly isolated and maybe not part of it. But of course, you know, by then I started forming relationships with other people through my foundation course. Even my teachers who were teaching me there were remarkable individuals that I'm still in touch with. And then the people that I lived with, you know, you start building community, and through this community, you become empowered somehow to survive, to, you know, to filter everything, not just on your own individually, but kind of more as a group. And I think that this was quite significant then.
You said at the time, you said that, you know, you thought that you'd be considered very uncool for speaking with a Polish accent and not being able to understand what people were saying necessarily, or you didn't watch EastEnders or particularly care. How do you now feel about the sort of YBA fetish of those years? Because you went to Goldsmiths and you did your MA.
Yes.
At Goldsmiths, which is the sort of the hothouse of the YBA movement, really.
Yes. Well, it's sort of, you know, it's the YBAs, William Blake and certain Paul Nash, certain iconic figures that, you know, you recognize within the history of British art. Of course, there's a number of them, but you would say that, that, you know, this has become already categorized, you know, this is part of the establishment. And I think that I probably even have less relationship to this now than I had then, because then I even, you know, I tried to actively be part of it. And I mean, saying this, you know, it was an incredible experience to discover Bank and go to different exhibitions that they did. You know, this was remarkable, really influenced how I thought of making art. And I still think that there were moments which were extremely inspiring. What did inspire me was more about the actual dynamic of getting together and having a great control over the whole kind of structure of whom you are, what you do, how you exhibit this, how you sell your work, how you publish the kind of critique on this work. And I think that this is what YBA brought to the platform for younger people like me then, to see that you have to be kind of able to manage all of this on your own. And I think that this started, well, I mean, of course, at Goldsmiths, in a way, we all knew that we had to get together in order to start our careers on every level. But I think that this was the aspiration that, you know, you kind of had to get there somehow. And the means of doing it were collaborative at the time.
Yes, that's very interesting, because they don't teach you, let's say, or how to survive as an artist once you leave art school, which has so many more roles and attributes to it than simply making art.
Yeah.
And you've said previously that, you know, your artistic practice is often referred to as taking on the roles of an artist, curator, collector, researcher, and exhibition designer. Can you tell us a bit more about this seemingly multiplicity of practices, but as you're saying, perhaps all incumbent in the process of being an artist?
Yes, so this wasn't really categorized at the beginning of the practice. I think that it has to more to do with the actual ways how I worked. So, you know, I started doing things by actually organizing shows in my flat with my partner at the time. And, you know, we invited lots of people that came and interacted with the context of our flat. And I think that I observed this really carefully. I mean, this was for us to be able to have shows, for us to be able to, in a way, create the narrative around showing the work. And of course, it was comfortable because it happened in the house. So you didn't have to rely on anyone. You didn't need a huge amount of money. But from this, I observed the actual narrative of the works and how the context really influenced what people did and how, you know, this whole kind of project grew over time, because we did a series of exhibitions. And how this could be easily manipulated. And I sort of really thought, this is the essence of what I want to do. I want to manipulate this context. And manipulating the context doesn't sound very positive. It's a slightly, you know, maybe more sinister way of seeing it. But it was very much about these adjustments that you do and somehow how you condition the reading of the work by what you build around it or where you place it. And I thought, actually, I do want to concentrate on exploring this avenue. And from then, I kind of went on to doing what I do now, and it has evolved. But also principally, as an artist, I wasn't interested in mastering a technique or having some kind of brand. You know, even this way of working or the methodology that I use usually to produce work, it formed itself or it has become labeled or recognized. And as you said at the beginning, all the categories that are attached to my practice are not, they never came from me. There were categories that kind of accumulated from different sort of articles or different critiques of my shows where people would refer to me as a curator or a collector. And I think that this need for categorizing, especially at that time, was very strictly linked also to the curating courses and the birth of curating courses. Because, you know, we in a way had to differentiate our activities, the artists and curators. And I think that that's how lots of these categories were born in a way.
I want to return to your MA at Goldsmiths. Was it influential on your practice? Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of teaching that you might have received in those years, what the atmosphere was like, and, you know, the kinds of relationships that you formed?
So I think that there were difficulties there. I mean, you know, already being in New Cross was pretty hardcore. And I had to travel there from Hammersmith every day. So, you know, it was hell on earth. You know, when you are 30 or like in your late 20s, you can really accept much more than you would have done later on. So I think that I struggled going, you know, through the whole London every day and staying there until late nights and eating, you know, fish and chips or Chinese food. There was nothing else to eat. And enjoying very much the relationships with other artists that were sharing the studio. Because, you know, of course, the whole thing was based on group studio practice and critique. And, you know, we had a number of tutors that I really enjoyed speaking to. I think that the great difficulty for me then was actually going to reading philosophy or books that were kind of expected from us to be our reading list, because I still had a great problem with actually properly understanding English language. But what was encouraging, I guess, was this idea of being able to kind of follow your own individual path, mm-hmm. you know, versus, for example, if I studied in Poland, you would have probably some kind of obligation to reflect on what your professors did. You know, so you would have to do something in the style of your professor. When I think that at Goldsmiths, we all really felt or had the pressure of creating something very individual. And in my case, I felt that it was rooted in my education in Poland, as well as, you know, the kind of things that interested me. And then the big challenge really was, how do you take this further beyond Goldsmiths? Because, of course, I was only there for 1 year. So, you know, it's nothing. In 1 year, you can't get much. And you've got this possibility of interaction and dialogue. And then you find yourself outside of it, and that's it. There's nothing there. So I think, and plus, I think that what Goldsmiths did to me, it was the kind of, you know, the thing of being put in a situation where you feel like you cannot lose out, that you have to get something out of it, you know, that you have to get somewhere, that this is some sort of foundation, but there is no way back. You have to go forward. So it's kind of ambition and aspiration. And so I think that there was quite a lot of pressure on us to become successful, really.
Which makes one understand why the YBAs may have been so successful, that self-starting DIY approach that they had, where they weren't waiting for institutional validation. Yeah. They went out and they almost created their own institutional validation before the museums turned up.
Of course, but you see, not everybody who makes art or is good at making art has got capacities of self-promotion. That's the problem. That in a way, you know, you really have to be to be Damien Hirst. You have to be Damien Hirst.
I agree. There's only one Damien
Hirst. Yes. Thanks God.
I'm sure he'd agree with you.
Yes.
It's been noted that you kind of have a polymathic kind of interest in systems of knowledge. And you also have a reputation of including other artists and welcoming other artists in your quite evocative installations. Where did this idea involving other artists in your own practice, in your own works, in fact, sometimes, or in your exhibitions, where does this come from?
So this was definitely still linked to this initial way of showing work with other artists and how the works almost became part of one organism and how the narrative became, so, you know, It was pretty simple. I mean, you know, you of course have got a lot of references of Duchamp doing activities like this, you know, at the beginning of 20th century. You know, we're talking about a long time ago. And I don't think that he was then really referred to as a curator. It was his sort of work that was inclusive of other work. And actually, the motives for doing that were probably the same as we had when we started doing shows with each other. It was about promoting you and your peers and your friends. But I thought that it was extremely fascinating how things overlapped. And I think that maybe not so much even the exhibitions that I did in my flat, but there was a moment where Dexter Dowd invited me and my partner to do a show at the Qubit space. And it was an exhibition that only lasted for 24 hours. And I proposed to do a show of rejects from people's studios. So, you know, we build up the structure of, it was called Mountain and a Valley. So we build up this mountain of furniture in the middle of the room, you know, covered this with sheets and bed sheets and stuff like this, and then place this kind of number, placed all these works that I collected from people's studios, because of course at the time the biggest task was for me, how do I get 50 works of 50 artists from all over London without having a car and money to create these moments, you know, where works overlapped. So the buildup of this environment, people literally wanted to throw this stuff out. And then the magic was created and we all gathered around this mountain and we looked at it. And suddenly the value of these rejects became very sentimental. You know, people really loved the things that they gave me and how these things talk to the other things. And I thought, this is it. It's these things that others would make or you would find that were produced by somebody else that meant something to these people or didn't even, you know, that just carried their own integral value, that it became almost like a language of quotation or like an editorial that I was very much interested in pursuing. And I think that that's how it then went on into a much more ambitious structure, you know, where you really think of the context, when you build up this context, when you borrow works from institutions, where you engage with other artists in, you know, in collaborative processes. I mean, the first kind of big challenge for me to exercise all these possibilities of working was, of course, the work that I did for Liverpool Biennial in 2006. You know, this was the first time when I really did it on a large scale.
Tell us about the work.
So the work was called Sleep of Urlo, and it was a new building which was run by the A Foundation. And they invited me to basically take on this big part of the new sort of space that they established and do whatever I wanted to do in there. And of course, it was quite hard to project onto the context because I quite like to often analyze the history of institution and things that already are embedded. So I created a context, and maybe the thing that first triggered some thought was mainly to do with the architecture that I was building. So, you know, I looked into, I mean, in terms of the content, it was very much about the idea of modernism and magic in a way that came together. And I don't know exactly how this came together. It was perhaps because of what I was watching then and what I was reading, you know, the things that I was exploring, that I decided to create this whole environment that was almost like some kind of device in her, you know, designed by a hermetic philosopher, where you could turn the ideas around like a clockwork and you could read them differently, depending how you enter that space. And there was, you know, there was this magic numbers that that in a way you know, orchestrated the dynamics, and also how many elements I have, you know, created and designed. I collaborated with two architects that helped me to, it was kind of like a big Renaissance theater. So by this reference, you already had a structure that would refer to the lower levels, middle levels, and upper levels. And of course, through this, you already had then references to hell, purgatory, and heaven. You know, you already, so things kind of, in a way, by putting a simple number of things together, there was already enough to explore. So, you know, for me, it's what triggers is one idea that immediately links to another idea. Then from this, you've got tons of material. And, you know, rather than focusing on one approach, you kind of turn around all these different ways how certain things can coexist together. It's kind of difficult, I think, to explain because it's so natural how this happens for me, you know, how you build up a context in a way or a narrative. And I think that now thinking, because it's so long ago, I wouldn't be able to tell you, I think, what was this first thought. But because I engaged with the production of this and the development of this project for 1 year, there was a kind of, you know, like a snowball effect where one thing linked to another. And then that show linked to a display that I did in Brazil as well for the biennial in 2006.
Later the Sao Paulo biennial.
Exactly. So, so it kind of worked like this, but within that structure, I collaborated with several people. I borrowed things from people. You know, I borrowed things from museums. So this possibility of, I collaborated with writers to, in a way, narrate over the display of the works that I collected. So this gave me the first feeling or taste of what can happen in something like this, in a complex artwork where, you know, many gestures are applied and there is no prohibition of to create a one-liner, but the actual principle is to expand as much as possible.
Well, that's really interesting because, you know, as has been described, you've been described as an artist, a curator, a collector, researcher, exhibition designer, and so on. And you've remarked that this sort of helps you determine your position within and making you a part of an art historical taxonomy. Can you explain that a little further?
So I would say that this, you know, obviously it's, again, this categorization or the need for categorization, it's not so much, I mean, of course, for me, it's quite useful to know that categories exist. But I would say that I don't really completely affiliate myself with the need for categorizing my practice. And I think that I've accepted that this is what happens. That's what we do in order to be able to communicate anything to do with what, you know, anything to do in terms of the evolution within the history of art or art history specifically. But, you know, for me, it's a very subjective activity and a very subjective need. And in a way, it only becomes structured when it's given to somebody else or when it comes out of the studio and becomes a public work or the work that it's, you know, elsewhere and no longer here and no longer in my head. Because in the ideal in an ideal situation, I think that I would like all these different connections and thoughts to continuously evolve and never really materialize as a work. But, you know, it doesn't happen like this. It would be, of course, it could be my choice to work like this without then having to translate it into the work. But saying this, I do have a pleasure of making things. I think that... what I don't like is the obligation, you know, to follow a path or to make something. And I think that that's why you probably see that in my work, there is no real commitment to a medium or to, it kind of comes and goes, you know, it's sort of more what is suitable within that particular situation.
So we're in your studio in Homerton in East London. And it's a week after the unveiling of your proposal for the fourth plinth project in Trafalgar Square. it must be a relief seeing this out there in public at last, because this was meant to be held last year, but of course it's been postponed because of the pandemic.
Yes, so this project has grew with time. Of course, there's almost 1 year delay of this moment of actual revelation of what our proposals were. So since of course, we were all locked in and we had time in a way to explore certain things further, I think obsessively focused on this project. And part of me feels really relieved that now everybody knows what our proposals are. And I also know what the other artists' proposals were, because of course, the whole process of the fourth plinth selection is that I think that there is a number of people that get proposed and discussed without, I think, these artists even knowing. And then only when the shortlist of six is revealed, then we get informed that we have been shortlisted to the six names. And we have time to then develop further our proposal and to build a maquette. So to kind of define more of what the project was. So if it followed the schedule that that was initially intended, the work would have been already revealed last summer. And of course, it wasn't that easy to even practically think of how to make a model or a maquette, because you couldn't go and visit people. And, you know, so kind of the normal ways of producing an artwork were quite limited. But it, of course, gave a lot of time to actually explore the potential content of it. And during the time, of course, you know, I initially proposed to build a rocket. I wanted this rocket to be contextualized within the history of British Empire and Trafalgar Square. I wanted the work to be humorous, so I made references even to different quotes from Monty Python, Galaxy Song. You know, there was different things that sort of, in a way, created these layers of interest. But then, of course, within the time since I proposed this in 2019 up to now, many things have happened. Black Lives Matter, the questioning of public space and monuments in public space. So all of this, in a way, made me think that perhaps it's a difficult time to put a work on a plinth and make this work again like an object where people can somehow look at, but be only passively involved with the work. And I thought perhaps it would be quite necessary for me to expand this work into another platform rather than just this formal sculpture. And then I basically decided that I would build a digital platform attached to the work that would evolve with time if my work was selected, that I could build it up to a kind of live, you know, growing digital platform website with which people could interact. And I focus, and plus, of course, this would help me for the work not to be misinterpreted or misunderstood. And this is really what I did over this whole year, which led now to the proposition of the to the revealing of the maquettes, and met really great people who helped me, whom I collaborated with on building the digital platform called Hato Studio. Also, other people collaborated with me in creating sort of like the first version of the website. Dieter Rostrata kindly wrote little kind of introductions to all the different chapters of the site. So there has been, you know, it has been a very exciting process, which kind of opens up the great possibility of also creating a brain behind the work that could exist forever. And I think that, you know, it's the first time when I'm trying to work in such a way, because of course I'm using, you know, digital platforms for research, and we all work with technology. but I've never really worked with technology in a sense that it can become sort of this living organism that you keep expanding within. So it has kind of allowed me to, in a way, expand the project and really change it quite fundamentally.
That's very interesting. And again, you're working in new mediums because you've commented that you have a kind of a lack of a commitment to a medium, which kind of commemorates your failure as a romantic artist.
Yes. You know, the medium, it's maybe more the belief that the mastering of the medium kills the work. So I think that this, the way, I mean, all the works that that I sort of really appreciate, or even observing how people evolve within the production of certain types of work, I usually have a greater attachment to either ephemera or very early works than these kind of big manifestations of artists' greatness. Plus, maybe, you know, it's also very personal because I don't have great patience of like sticking to one thing and just staying with one thing. I like to jump from one thing to another. So I think that there is many reasons why, you know, I don't have this commitment to a medium. And plus, of course, for example, proposing a rocket, building digital platform or building a robot, if I did only concentrate on, for example, identifying myself with such as work, how many opportunities do you have in life to do something like this? So, you know, if there are no big projects or invitations to do a public sculpture, it's quite nice to make a little painting or take a photograph. You know, it's about having a working method that allows you to do it in any circumstances all the time, wherever you are, you know. So, it's a kind of lifestyle.
That's very interesting. Talking about our lives and lifestyles, I want to return. You mentioned Black Lives Matter and some of the other socio-political moments of reckoning that we've had, which I would include Brexit in this country, and you being of Polish origin and descent, who've made your life here in the UK. How do you feel about our divorce from the EU?
Well, it is pretty traumatizing because I left my country and came here because I felt that I was in some way isolated there, or I didn't have the ability to have a great reach to, you know, to the kind of big cosmopolitan platform. And now I'm finding myself on the island, which chose to be isolated from the race in a symbolic way from the rest of Europe. So in one way, as an artist, you know, I already feel it now, because to send any work abroad, it's now expensive and there's huge amount of paperwork just for a show, for a loan, even to another institution. Plus, of course, the travel, I mean, plus the pandemic. You know, I haven't been anywhere for 1 year now. I've opened few works, other public sculptures in Belgium recently. I have not been able to see the site, so I designed the work without actually essentially looking at the context. I have not been able to research as I would have done in libraries or you know, materials which would be much more based in the original language rather than English. So all I can do, it limits me. All I can do is to access stuff through, you know, Google search or phone calls or books that I can access here. And then of course, you know, it's just the consciousness of being somehow not part of something bigger that is quite depressing. Of course, this also fed very much to the project for the fourth plinth. And the project is called Go No Go. So first of all, it very much resembles the slogans of Brexit, leave or stay, and the dilemmas that we generally have, you know, how indecisive we are in general sense. But it very much links to these slogans. And it's also about this continuous kind of, I guess, struggles that we have with the sizing of where we belong to. You know, so a space program very much embodies that. You know, we want to go elsewhere, and through this we can perhaps solve our problems here. But I mean, it's almost like a Confucius philosophy that says that you have to go away in order to come back. So these aspirations of leaving in order to categorize what your relationship is to your actual place is somehow conditioned within the human conscious. But I think that Brexit has been really a pretty severe way of justifying that. And I think that we, you know, we all feel it already. I don't really see anything positive coming out of it. And of course, I mean, this goes to the extent of lots of people leaving the country and going to live somewhere else if they can. And potentially even me considering this, you know, definitely wanting not to just feel part of the context in the UK, but thinking that perhaps there is a possibility somehow how I could make my life elsewhere again.
Where are you thinking?
Well, I probably wouldn't be going back to Poland, because we know that Poland now is even in the worst situation politically. But I'm kind of trying to think maybe of spending more time in Greece. You know, it's like a new possible kind of place where lots of artists. Well, I love an island. There's an island which I really like called Kythira. And I'm sort of already in the process of trying to figure out how to potentially spend some time there. You know, it's a very, I mean, it's a place where you can really feel isolated, but not in the same way how you would be feeling isolated in the UK from Europe. It's a place where you really feel isolated from humanity in a way, and how you can maybe start justifying your own identity without anyone else. So that's what I'm planning to do.
Well, that sounds a little bit like in my other conversations over the last 12 months with so many artists, that this has been a period of isolation, of contemplation, of introspection, etc. So what has the last year been? Has it been a period of stillness, or has it been productive? I mean, you mentioned these projects that were sort of somehow had to find a new way of continuing.
Yes, there is isolation, a various solitude, you know, where you choose to be on your own, or where you are conditioned to be on your own. And I think that I have suffered, and lots of people have suffered, from the fact that it wasn't a choice, that we had to stay isolated and we couldn't see each other. But I think that this romantic idea of solitude has always been appealing to me. You know, I do like this. And as I said to you, being able to work in diverse ways, I can be on my own and I can be anywhere with very little and still make work somehow. So there was actually a shift, maybe, because of course when the when it was first announced that we had to stay at home, I panicked so much that I would have to stay at home, that my partner and I, we packed the house within 2 hours, took the dog, and we moved to the studio here with our bed, because I don't have anywhere to sleep here. And plus with everything we needed to, you know, to survive for months, like without having to go and buy anything. And then, of course, this really very much changed the way how I worked. First of all, I could work as long as I could. You know, I didn't have to finish at 8 o'clock and go home. I could just do stuff here. And plus, I could do things that I never had time to do. So I started painting again. You know, it was like a huge experiment, which in a way was kind of helping me to form the shape of the rocket. You know, so I started painting rockets with like paint, like house paint that I had left from decorating my house, you know, because I had no paints here. I couldn't go to the shop really and buy anything. I thought, it doesn't matter. I can just use emulsion, you know, and I can just paint on paper with emulsion paint. So this was one thing. Then I got back to dancing. every day I did this sort of 1 hour dancing, which is something that I love doing as well. And then I started, and then of course I opened for the first time in my life an Instagram account just to connect with the close friends that I couldn't see who lived in other countries as well. And I didn't want to make it as my artistic account. So I opened the account as my dog. And then of course that motivated me to, in a way, choreograph this whole account from this perspective of a talking dog. So I did lots of little video works where I would make commentaries, you know, things that in a way I find very embarrassing, but I allowed myself to do it because, you know, we were living in crisis and then it didn't matter what you do as long as you could express yourself in this context. So in a way, all of this was something that I would never anticipate otherwise, but I did it. And I'm kind of glad that I did it. You know, it certainly taught me something about just the way of working and the kind of professionalism that it's usually expected from artists. You know, that you know, there's a shame of maybe making certain things or experimenting on certain things and making them public. There is also this expectation that one imposes on oneself of being very professional and sticking to a certain conduct of working. In a way, all of this was broken. And most of all, it was very much about not being able to really know what the future will be. So you kind of had to be busy in that moment, but you couldn't really design things for the future because everything was changing continuously and still is. So whatever you plan, it never happens. You know, you never know that this show or this work, even if you work to the end, will actually at the end materialize. You know, I was working to do an exhibition in New Zealand. I've never been to New Zealand or Australia. And of course, you know, we had meetings. It was difficult talking with New Zealand because it's such a great time difference. And then of course, immediately the whole thing dissolved. It was impossible to do the show. So there were things like this and still are, that there's lots of question marks. So I think that if I had to summarize this, it was very much about how do you work in complete and utter uncertainty? How do you work with the very simple means that you have access to? And how do you work without being able to have contact with other people? You know, these were the conditions that I had to somehow address within this last now year and a half or a year, at least.
It's really fascinating. And thank you for being so honest and open, which was an incredibly difficult time, I think, for everybody. I want to return to your dog and your Instagram account. I invited you last year to take part in the Passing Time project, for which you sent a video of this mongrel in a sort of shallow pond speaking. It was absolutely hilarious. Whose voice was that?
So I basically downloaded an app. It was very simple. It's an app which allows you to take a photograph and to animate this photograph and to also record a voice. And there are different parameters how you can change the pitch of the voice and the speed of it. It's just that. So I was using this app mainly. And then when I did a more elaborate version recently of something like this, I actually used an editing program. But most of the most of these videos were made with this app, which is called My Talking Pet.
So
I sold to everyone, you know, the way how I made the thing so everybody can do it themselves.
And so what's the name of the account?
Yeah, so the account is called Greca and Friends. So it's the name of my dog. You know, it's not, it's just a kind of fun name.
Yeah. And are you going to do anything with these videos, or will they remain on Instagram?
Well, they remain on Instagram. I think that there was only few of them that triggered kind of a thought from other people to elaborate on, which I did, little kind of video projects, which are kind of very much rooted in this Instagram account. But no, I don't think that I will be really building up on it, you know, building up a whole career on this. So it's still quite private and still quite friends and friends of the friends that have access to it.
And the words that this dog speaks in the video that you contributed towards Passing Time, absolutely hilarious. Tell us a little bit more about what the dog is saying.
Well, it's all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's political commentary, it's commentary on environment, it's commentaries on isolation, commentaries on engaging, being bored, you know, this sort of stuff. So it's a whole spectrum. It's kind of literally like little thoughts or little poems that can become a song or can become a little monologue speech. That don't aspire to be an essay, you know, that they allow, they are completely, they can be ridiculous. And in a way, this was the,
it's very absurd,
the principle, yes. Mm. So there's really all sorts of stuff. I mean, it very much links to the identity of the dog, because I rescued this dog from Greece. Mm. It deals with my identity, and I had a very interesting sort of interaction with a couple of small children, daughters of a friend of mine, who really, lots of children like this video. So they came to me and they said to me, you know, we really love watching Greca and Friends, but we just wanted to ask you a question. Why do you hide behind Greca rather than saying all this stuff yourself? And I thought, yes, this is kind of like a really amazing question. Why have I not done something like this as me? But I think that the answer to it is, you know, maybe there is a certain kind of pressure of being identified or identifying the method of working and feeling that this is so far away from it that maybe I will not allow myself to commit this. And I think that, yeah, this was a different time when I did allow myself to go that path. But normally, I think that it's pretty rigorous how I work. Yeah, that's sort of the summary, in a way, of this little Instagram instance versus the usual practice, I guess.
And apart from Instagram, what got you through the lockdown? You were here in the studio with your partner. Books, music, films?
Lots of films.
What kind of films?
Anything. I mean, you know, I can't even tell you what I have seen. I watch every day at least one or two movies, every day, religiously, 7 days a week, regardless what time I go to sleep. So, you know, from classics and old stuff that I have loads of DVDs. I've always really liked movies, but I've watched a huge amount of new stuff that is coming up. And of course, you know, now it's a limitation of how there's not going to be as many movies released this year as you would have had before the pandemic. So, you know, yes, I've watched a lot, but I think that the thing that I treasured the most during the lockdown was again re-establishing my relationship with nature. Because, you know, most of the time when I live at home and I come here, the routine is live there in the midst of Dalston, come to Homerton, to my studio on my bicycle or by train then. In fact, I used to always travel by overground. And so even if you saw a plant or a flower, sometimes you kind of thought, oh, I forgot that they exist. And then, of course, living here has allowed me to explore Hackney Marshes. So every day I went to Hackney Marshes for extremely long walks and observed the changes in seasons and in nature in that specific spot. But I mean, it's a pretty diverse environment with a river, trees, you know, all these amazing plants.
wildlife and
yes, wildlife, yeah. British wildlife. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing to see the existence of it and how it changes, you know, and how impoverished our lives are.
Something that we would normally overlook, but...
Or we would do it maybe once in a year, you know. I mean, of course, people have gardens. I don't even have a garden. So it was amazing to reestablish the need for it and how much it means to you. And plus then, of course, the second thing was the relationship to dancing. You know, that I danced every single day. And it wasn't anything conceptual. You know, it was literally all about just culture of music and dancing, which would be perhaps more attached to clubbing rather than actual classical dancing. So these were the main highlights, in a way, of this whole lockdown experience.
And finally, I think I want to end on this note, but I wanted to know what you've got coming up for the rest of the year and next year. Things have been delayed. You've got the fourth plinth that's going to be announced next month, I think, the winner of that. And you've got an exhibition in Belgium, you mentioned. What are the other things that are coming up?
So the fourth plinth, of course, is a big question mark, because if this, if I was selected, I would really have to concentrate very hard on the expansion of this digital content and the logistics of building the sculpture, which would be really a lot of work, because I would have to do a lot of studies, of engineering studies, and really engaged with this. Of course, you know, the selection of two artists also would then determine who would get the sculpture in 2022 and who would get it in 2024. So everything has been really on standby because, you know, I simply don't know what will happen there. So this is very difficult, but, you know, I'm already thinking, because this project is so precious to me, I'm already thinking, what will I do with this if I don't get it? It certainly can't die. And can I make this work outside of the initial reference to the British context, and specifically context of Trafalgar Square? And I think that it could definitely work somehow. So there is a possibility of maybe doing something with this or in the lines of this in Mexico, which would then, of course, bring much different layers to the work. And the work would have not materialized in the physical form, but perhaps the digital form could really take a certain direction. Then, you know, there's a few other things which I shouldn't really tell you about, because I haven't committed to doing it yet. And if I did it, it would still have to be some kind of more secret approach, which I can tell you later. But there are commercial shows that I supposed to kind of work towards, like the show with Andrew Krebs next year in New York. Again, I don't know if I will go there. I have no idea what it will be about. You know, it's all this stuff that it's kind of, but nothing as big as the fourth plinth for sure. So little bits and pieces of stuff that can evolve different direction in a way.
Thank you. And I wish you the best of luck with your fourth plinth proposal and the rest of your year. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Mishka. Thank you. Thanks for your time.